The first woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court was honored at the University of Montana today. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce takes us to a special campout. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a researcher at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories about a successful new treatment of a deadly infection. Retired U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor received an honorary doctorate of laws from the University of Montana today. In 1981, O'Connor became the first woman to serve on the High Court, retiring in 2006. In 2009, President Barack Obama awarded O'Connor the Presidential Medal of Freedom in recognition of her lifetime achievements. O'Connor delivered the inaugural address in UM Law School's Jones-Tam Lecture Series in 1997, and the law faculty recommended her for the honorary degree she received today. Governor Steve Bullock was among the dignitaries in attendance. He says Justice O'Connor represents the best of what a judge should be, and he thanked her for her pioneering example.
Because of your work, because of Justice O'Connor's work and leadership, the opportunities open to my daughters are light years away from the opportunities open to her when she graduated at the top of her class at Stanford Law School. Through her career, Justice O'Connor broke down those barriers, crashed through that glass ceiling, making the path for my Caroline and my Alexandria not only that much more clear, but also without limitation. So as a father and as a citizen, thank you so very much.
Justice O'Connor used her remarks not to reminisce about her illustrious career, but to urge everyone to become involved in their community at whatever level. And she lamented the lack of civic knowledge in young people today.
In recent years, two-thirds of all students have scored below proficiency on nationwide civics assessment tests. Less than one-tenth of eighth graders can name the three branches of government, much less say what they do.
O'Connor has started a website called iCivics that teaches government in innovative ways, including video games. But she's serious about the issue.
Our nation faces many daunting economic and policy changes. And how can we expect the next generations to have constructive debates about these challenges when they haven't even learned the skills necessary for discourse and dialogue as it stands? And even more fundamentally, how can we expect the next generation to care about, to cherish and sustain our democratic institutions when they don't know what they are or how they work?
O'Connor's affection for Montana and UM are evident. She's been here several times to lecture and to fish.
So as a Westerner and as an avid fly fisherwoman, these visits to your beautiful state, your beautiful campus, have been a special joy to me.
O'Connor also spent time with high school and university honors students earlier today and will meet with law students tomorrow.
And in other news from around the state, the largest union of Montana University System employees has ratified a deal with the Commissioner of Higher Education regarding pay raises. State lawmakers gave the Montana University System $19 million earlier this year for employee raises. The university system has to negotiate with each union individually. The Montana Public Employee Association makes the biggest chunk of those unionized employees, 1,700 workers. The pay raises ratified by the MPEA will give a 46 cent per hour base pay raise to those employees this October. Then, starting October of 2014, the workers would receive a 2.25% raise plus another 12 cents per hour. MPEA Executive Director Quentin Nyman says the Montana Board of Regents will need to take a final vote on the agreement next week to make it official, but that should be a formality.
I can't imagine the Board of Regents turning this down. I've never seen an employer entity at that level turn a contract down that's been negotiated and ratified.
The Office of the Commissioner of Higher Education says the Regents will be voting on 10 union pay raise contracts next week, as well as raises for the university system's non-union workers.
A U.S. district judge has upheld the release of a Montana newlywed accused of killing her husband by pushing him off a cliff at Glacier National Park. The Missoulian reports that Judge Donald Malloy determined today that 22-year-old Jordan Lynn Graham does not pose a flight risk. Malloy said during a brief hearing that restrictions placed on Graham's release address concerns that she poses a risk to the community or herself. Authorities say Graham has admitted to shoving Cody Lee Johnson off a cliff in Glacier on the night of July 7th during an argument. He was released on her own recognizance yesterday and ordered into home detention at her parents' house in Kalispell. Prosecutors wanted her jailed pending a trial for second-degree murder.
A federal judge has granted a request from the Nez Perce tribe and an environmental group to temporarily stop shipments of giant oil field equipment from moving across a winding Idaho highway. U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill issued the ruling this morning, barring Omega Morgan from shipping the so-called mega loads along Highway 12 until certain conditions are met. The highway passes through the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest and through the Nez Perce tribe's reservation land, and the tribe and Idaho Rivers United sued because they contend the route isn't appropriate and the shipments could cause irreparable harm to the rights of the Nez Perce people. Omega Morgan says it could face millions in damages if it's prevented from getting the equipment to Canada's tar sands in an efficient and timely manner.
Governor Steve Bullock says it would be inappropriate for him to offer an opinion on Barry Beach's request to be set free before the process plays out. Beach's attorney sent an application for commutation or a reduction of sentence to members of the State Board of Pardons and Parole on Wednesday. Beach has served nearly 30 years of a 100-year sentence after being convicted in 1983 of the 1979 murder of Kimberly Neese in Poplar. Beach was released in 2011 for 18 months after a Lewistown judge ruled there was enough new evidence in the case to justify a new trial. That decision was reversed by the state Supreme Court, and Beach went back to jail. Bullock said he will wait to see what the parole board recommends.
Cascade County prosecutors have filed five more felony charges against a Great Falls man who has a youth court conviction for rape and faces four other rape charges for attacks that reportedly happened in February and March. The Great Falls Tribune reports 19-year-old Christian Underdahl was charged yesterday with three accounts of sexual intercourse without consent and two counts of sexual assault for repeated sexual contact with one or more girls, ages 12 and 13 between December 2011 and June 2012. Underdahl was convicted in youth court last November for sexual intercourse without consent and placed on probation until he turns 21. In February, he was charged with rape and released on $10,000 bond. Three more counts were added in April after a 14-year-old girl reported Underdahl raped her repeatedly in late March. He remains jailed on $350,000 bail.
A California man says he's lucky to be alive after crushing a vertebrae under his lower back in a 40-foot fall in a crevice in Glacier National Park. Ted Porter of Los Angeles told the Daily Interlake that it was raining when he slipped on the ice while climbing Jackson Glacier on September 3rd. He said he was in extreme pain, but he knew he needed to get out and go for help or he wasn't going to make it. Just in case, he made a video on his cell phone telling his parents what happened and that he loved them. Porter found a way out of the crevice, but still had to walk about 3 miles to a campground. The campers tended to him through the night and went for help in the morning.
By now, high school students around the state are adjusting back to life in the classroom. However, for about a dozen teenagers in Helena's alternative high school, little of that class time so far has been indoors. The Project for Alternative Learning, or PAL, provides another option to kids who struggle in a traditional high school setting. Students take classes in blocks lasting just a few weeks at a time. Many of those classes emphasize hands-on experiential learning out in the community, or in this case, out in the woods. Capital reporter Dan Boyce joins a camp out with PAL's Primitive Elements class.
Hey, are we ready?
Yeah.
There you go.
A group of teens out on about 20 acres of riparian landscape near the town of Cardwell. Ponds, a river, willow stands, tall grass. And what are they doing? Well, they're taking a lot of that grass and they're weaving it and twisting it into a long, thick rope thing.
You guys want to test this out, see how strong it is?
Yeah.
Facilitator Tom Elpel suggests a game of tug-of-war.
You want to try boys against girls? I know there's
yeah.
more girls.
Yeah. Yeah.
A battle of the sexes begins.
Alrighty. Go. Oh, that wasn't that one.
And the grass rope promptly splits down the middle, sending boys and girls to the dirt.
Is that, like, not supposed to happen, maybe?
No, definitely not. Oh, well.
Tom Elpel runs a program out here called the Outdoor Wilderness Living School, or OWLS. The Project for Alternative Learning students have been prepping to come out to Elpel's land for weeks. For 4 hours a day, almost every day of the school year so far, they've been outside learning primitive survival tasks. Like starting a fire with a stick and a bow. 17-year-old senior Casey Cotis says the class made wooden bowls by putting hot coals on logs.
And we made these straws out of a plant that grew near the river. And we blew in them and we made wooden bowls. That was unique. I've never done that before.
There's a lot most of these students have never done before. For some, it's the more novel things like trying to stalk game barefoot. But for others, like senior Caitlin Stahl, it's the more basic things.
I learned how to go to the bathroom in the woods.
I talked through an outdoor pee. Yeah.
That's one of Caitlin's teachers, Emily Peterson. She teaches PALS science classes, and she's co-teaching the primitive elements class with English teacher Sarah Alling. On Peterson's end, the teens have learned about the science of water purification, the science of fire. On the English side, Sarah Alling has them studying poetry about subjects like fire, myth, and legend. The students are writing stories and journaling.
For them to, you know, really not only appreciate nature, but to find out that nature can teach them about themselves.
The PAL kids are layering extra sticks and grasses onto the outside of the girls' teepee-shaped shelter, made entirely of natural found items. It's about 10 feet tall, creating a space about 10 feet in diameter. 8 girls plus teacher Emily Peterson will be sleeping in here.
Looks like they're pretty tight quarters for 9.
Yeah.
We'll be warmer than the guys will be.
Yeah.
The 4 boys will be sleeping in a bigger shelter. Teacher Sarah Alling says on one hand, they do have a group of rambunctious teenagers sleeping in the woods together.
What are the kinds of things you have to deal with as a teacher?
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
On the other hand, she says the boys and girls are carefully separated overnight and chaperoned. A lot of the kids smoke cigarettes, but Alling says the group has made a pact to respect Tom Elpel's property and to not run off or disappear, to stay together through this. Alling says for these kids who have struggled in school, who may have dyslexia or another learning disability, for these kids, she says it's these kinds of real-life experiences out in the world which can generate excitement about learning.
Because they haven't had that. Yeah. That's why they're here with us. They'd be dropped out.
You have to cross the water because somebody destroyed our...
Senior Mitzi Gilmet is carrying skateboard-sized sections of bark over to the girls' shelter.
In the high school, I didn't really get much help there.
She says coming to PAL last year, the teaching style just works better for her. She says it makes her want to come to school.
It makes me feel like I don't have to just sit there and hear a teacher lecture us. And we're out doing stuff instead.
It's really cool.
She heads off down the trail. The shelter has to be finished soon. It's almost time to make dinner as a class. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting outside Cardwell.
National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases scientists say a drug combination may prove quite useful in treating an emergency respiratory virus that's proven fatal outside the United States. Research conducted at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories in Hamilton, Montana, was key to this discovery. As of April, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus had infected 17 people in the Middle East and Europe, killing 11 of them. In this evening's feature interview, Daryl Falzerano, a visiting fellow member at RML, explains how he and his colleagues found a drug combination that is showing promise in treating this new and frequently fatal infection.
So we're talking about a new respiratory disease that's just emerged, I guess, within the last year. So far, the case fatality rate is hovering around 50%, although it's up and down depending on the day. It results in severe respiratory infection that causes a syndrome called ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Basically, the virus causes enough damage that your lungs are poorly or non-functional, and obviously if it's to such a limit that they're not functional and any supportive care isn't sufficient to make up for that, you know, that's what's leading to fatal outcomes.
And it's transmitted primarily how and in what part of the world?
All the cases have originated from the Middle East to date, except some secondary cases, let's say in the UK. All the initial primary cases originated somewhere out of the Middle East, most of them out of Saudi Arabia. Transmission is close contact between individuals, so there hasn't really been transmission when there's not close contact. So it's always been to family members or for example, people in a renal dialysis unit that are in contact with each other every couple days for hours at a time.
I don't know if I read or interpreted this correctly, but is it true that this was first identified September of last year? Is that right?
Correct, yeah, in one patient from Saudi Arabia.
It just strikes me as so odd. Again, knowing nothing about your field, I have this notion that science has basically known about most, if not all, the viruses, diseases, infections out there, even if we don't necessarily know how to defeat all of them.
No, there's actually, I guess, thousands of undiscovered viruses. I think there's an article out last week where they're proposing there's over 300,000, they think, unidentified viruses carried in mammals alone, based on some estimates and some mathematical modeling. So that shows or indicates that there's really a wide spectrum of viruses that we still don't know about. And of course, many of these aren't going to cause disease, but every now and then something's going to jump from natural host, where maybe there's not a lot of disease in that animal, to another host. For example, in this case, in humans, where we do see significant disease.
Oh, interesting. And this, again, resistant to traditional therapies.
So therapies for viral infections are always really complicated, and a lot of the time there's not very good therapies. So resistant maybe isn't the right word. It's not like the bacteria field where antibiotics are available for a lot of things. Broad-spectrum antivirals, for the most part, don't exist.
So then how did this problem, this case, end up at the Rocky Mountain Labs in Hamilton?
So we work on emerging viruses. That's kind of one of our fields of interest. So this is definitely an emerging virus. Our group's had experience before with different emerging flu viruses as well. Heinz worked back in Winnipeg on when SARS emerged 10 years ago. So it was kind of a natural fit when MERS emerged to jump in and see if we can provide some kind of assistance for global public health.
Using concepts and language that I and so many of our listeners can understand, wrap our arms around, how do you and your colleagues approach this? Where do you begin?
So one of the things that's always useful when you have a new virus is to have an animal model. Of course, there's lots you can do in cell culture, but for doing any further testing, you do need some sort of animal model. And that's something our group does a lot, is develop animal models and validate them. So that's what we did here. Initially, you always start with a small animal model. So us and other groups have attempted that first, of course. So other people have tried putting MERS into mice. Our groups have worked on hamsters. Other people have worked on ferrets. And unfortunately, none of these animals show any signs of disease or even infection. So that led us to trying something a little bigger. So we moved to the rhesus macaque model to see if we could establish an infection model there. And in fact, we can. And it actually does show disease as well.
Why in the macaques and not necessarily the smaller critters?
So in the rodents, it seems to be a receptor issue. The receptor for this virus is DPP4. And rodents do express this, but it appears that rodents and rodent tissues, their version of DPP4 is not efficiently bound by MERS, and therefore the virus doesn't get in and cause infection at all.
Maybe take this opportunity. Perhaps some of our listeners will say they have a real ethical problem with using animals in these studies and would ask, are there better alternatives than using animals?
So not really. So, of course, before we did treatment, we always look in vitro, so in cell culture, and that's what we did here. We established that the two drugs we used in the study, interferon and ribavirin, both had effects in cell culture. Normally, we would move to a small animal first and make sure we see efficacy there. It's very atypical for us to move into the non-human primates immediately following in vitro work, but given the lack of a small animal model, there really was no choice, and we felt the data was compelling enough and the situation for public health important enough that we made that jump.
Okay, so then again, what led you all to find out what worked and what did not work?
So interferon and ribavirin are both already identified as antiviral drugs. They're used in combination for hepatitis C quite widely. And it was previously reported that for SARS, both interferon and ribavirin arguably had some effect and that they did work better together. So we went basically with what you know. We expected that one or both of them would have some effect, and what we found is that together their effect was better than either separately. And this is from work in cell culture, and so we went ahead and tested the combination in non-human primates.
This is assuming a quick diagnosis. In other words, you know these primates were recently infected. How does this combination work in more advanced cases?
So that's going to be one of the difficulties, and something I think that we kind of make clear in our paper, and we've been telling people over and over and trying to reinforce that with any viral infection, if you wait till the patient is near death and you expect to go in with drugs that are antiviral, the chance of them being effective is really quite low or non-existent. Patients really need to be treated early. So you need good diagnostics, and then you would need the confidence to treat patients early in the course of disease and not wait till severe disease onset before you consider treatment. And I think that's the time when we would expect this combination to be the most effective.
And are doctors in that part of the world, are they learning more and more about this? Would they be more prepared to make quick diagnoses?
Diagnostics from a technology point of view, there's absolutely, I think, no real limitations there. Assays are extremely sensitive and specific. The problem is the specimens that need to be collected. You require, really it seems, a lower respiratory tract specimen instead of an upper respiratory tract specimen, and that's a little bit more complicated to obtain and a lot more invasive. So if you have a person walking into your office with just flu-like symptoms, likely you're not going to be taking a lower respiratory tract sample. That's only going to come later on when they get more ill and don't respond to the first go-to antibiotics.
In the lower system, and you said invasive, does that mean surgery or something else?
Not surgery, but taking like a bronchial sample, so needing to do like a tracheal wash. So inserting a tube down the trachea and just doing wash with fluid. And of course, that also puts the people doing the procedure at a little bit more risk than, say, doing a throat swab.
Okay, so you and your team cracked this nut. What now? Are these drugs being used in real cases or not quite there yet?
Reports in the media have indicated that they have used interferon or ribavirin in some cases. Most of the people, they've used it very late in their disease process, and they've indicated that that really hasn't been that successful. And again, to myself, that's really not that surprising. People need to be treated early in the course of infection, not 1 or 2 days before they die, unfortunately. That's just too late. And so that decision needs to be made a little earlier. One of the complicating factors is both these drugs do have significant or serious side effects that need to be accounted for, and there needs to be a balance between, you know, the risk of using these drugs and the risk of developing serious MERS disease, which is occurring because you have to look at a 50% case fatality rate at the moment.
What are some potential side effects?
The side effect profile, at least, is very well defined for these drugs because they are used frequently and in a large population. Ribavirin causes hemolytic anemia. It's reversible, though, so once you stop taking the drug, you do recover from that. And, of course, that's manageable during the clinical course. And most of these people are in hospital facilities that definitely have the ability to manage these problems. Interferon causes some immune suppression and bone marrow suppression. They also have some unpleasant side effects. Interferon induces fever temporarily following administration. It's possible that you get other local reactions to it as well. But again, the side effect profiles for both these drugs are quite well defined, and people who use them regularly are aware of what those side effects would be and how to deal with them.
It took 1 year to crack this case. Why so fast?
I guess a bunch of things fell into place rather quickly. So shortly after receiving the virus here, I guess to go back even further, once a physician in Saudi Arabia identified that they had something unusual in this person, they partnered with some other labs who were able to identify the virus quite quickly and determine the full sequence and diagnostics, again, in short order. And then people started working on animal models. Our group just happened to come up with the right animal model rather quickly, and then we work on treatments for other viral diseases. So knowing what there was pre-existing with SARS, it made sense to go to this drug combination. And so, yeah, in this case, things did move along fairly quickly. I mean, this is not an optimal treatment yet, but it's definitely something that could be tried.
Should we be surprised, I guess, lastly, Daryl, that this important work is being done at the little lab right here in Western Montana?
No, I don't think you should be surprised. I think a lot of important work actually goes on here and I wouldn't say it's that little either. I guess there's 450 people that work here who are, you know, very dedicated to their fields of research. So I think a lot of important work comes out of this little area in Hamilton, Montana. No, I don't think that's surprising at all.
Daryl Falzarano, listen, I very much appreciate your time and congratulations again.
All right, thank you.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect partly cloudy skies with isolated showers and thunderstorms and lows in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be in the upper 70s to mid-80s. Sunday calls for mostly sunny skies in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs will be in the mid-70s to lower 80s. For central Montana, tonight look for partly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and isolated thunderstorms. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms through the day and highs around 70 to 80 degrees. Sunday will be partly cloudy with highs in the 70s to 80s. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for rain showers and isolated thunderstorms with lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow, look for mostly sunny, cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be around 70 to 80 degrees. Sunday, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and highs around 65 to 75 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Terry Kendrick.
Last night, I was eating dinner at a restaurant in Missoula, and there were flyers on the tables from the group No Kid Hungry, letting people know that a portion of what they spent on dinner would go to programs that help feed hungry children. Before I go on, I better offer up my own disclaimer. I work for an agency that is part of a coalition working to end childhood hunger. And as you might well imagine, there are no easy solutions to this problem. There are millions of families who don't have enough food. The current phrase to describe this is food insecurity. I am not a fan of the term. It's a euphemism, and what's more, it sounds like a psychological problem. I'm insecure about my looks, my age, oh, and food. Can't we just say there are millions of families in this country that regularly don't have enough food? In 2011, more than 16.5 million children in this country did not have enough food to get the nutrition they need for their growing bodies and developing brains. 16.5 million kids. It's about the same number as all the people who live in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Colorado combined. Montana is not immune from this epidemic. 90,000 children under the age of 18, a full 20% of Montana's children, live in homes that regularly do not have enough food. Being continually hungry has severe consequences for children. As students, they get lower math and reading scores. They are more likely to have reduced language and motor skills, and they are frequently absent because of illness. These children are more likely to have to repeat a grade. They show signs of anxiety, aggression, and other behavior problems. All of these symptoms arise because they are not getting enough to eat. Even if you are not swayed by the moral argument that no one, especially children, should have to be hungry, think of it from a practical point of view. We depend on our children to grow up healthy, to do well in school, so that they can become the next generation of teachers, welders, doctors, civic leaders, and yes, home health care providers. We can't afford to turn our backs on the thousands of children in Montana and the millions of children in this country who simply aren't getting enough to eat. Childhood hunger has grown to such proportions that it cannot be solved by the work of food pantries, local churches, and community food drives alone. These locally based programs do a great job, and they are a necessary part of the solution. Families would be devastated without them, but they are not sufficient to end childhood hunger. We need strong public policy to go along with community-based solutions. If businesses do not pay enough for workers to make a living wage, the federal government needs to step in and do more to supplement family income when wages aren't enough. Families need stronger unemployment insurance, low-income tax credits, and assistance for health care and child care. It's also time to increase the monthly allocation for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. SNAP is the best way seniors, parents, children, and others get the food they need. However, the maximum monthly amount is so low that it doesn't allow families to have enough food for the whole month. The monthly allotment for a person in Montana is $127. That works out to about $4.25 a day. Many families are often a week or more short of food at the end of every month. If a family wants to stretch its food budget, it's much cheaper to buy processed food rather than fresh meat and produce. You can eat fluorescent orange Kraft macaroni and cheese for much less than it takes to cook a meal. We should each take the challenge to eat on $4.25 a day for a week. It might give us some new perspective on what it's like for low-income families and the choices they make. It's time to take some action. We cannot be daunted by the enormity of the task. We cannot stand idly by while the number of hungry children continues to rise. Here in Montana, there are hardworking people who are taking on this challenge, and they are sponsoring a conference on September 23rd and 24th at MSU Bozeman, titled Build a Stronger Montana, End Childhood Hunger. The conference will highlight the best practices in local strategies and public policy, as well as give you the opportunity to hear what others are doing in the state and around the country to combat childhood hunger. Just Google Build a Stronger Montana, and you will find more information. I hope you can attend. This is Terry Kendrick. Thanks for listening.
Terry Kendrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.